Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Damage Report. It is going to be a gigantic show. We've got so much we want to get to. We're going to be starting off the show in just a couple of minutes with Trump's new budget proposal, which is a turd. We're going to be breaking down all the different ways that it is feces. Later on the show, lots to get to, including Media Matters dumping even more clips of Tucker Carlson from over the last decade. I would say worse than what we talked about on the show yesterday. So we'll be breaking down some of the worst excerpts from that. We're going to be closing out the show with AOC at South by Southwest in a clip we unfortunately couldn't get to yesterday. And that is her decrying meh politics and putting into words a feeling that I have been having for quite some time, which I'm going to break down. It's going to be awesome, so you're going to want to stick around to the end for that. Along the way, two great guests are going to be joining us. So Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland is going to be back on the show to talk about Nancy Pelosi's new position on presidential impeachment, as well as some other breaking news. And later on, Pam Vogel of Media Matters is going to be joining us to talk about Sebastian Gorka and how Sinclair is beaming his Islamophobic commentary into hundreds of markets around the country. So all that and more over the course of the next hour. Everybody buckle up. We're starting with the budget. Donald Trump has released the new outline for his proposed fantastical federal budget, and it's awful. By now, you've probably seen some of the details. You understand overall that it's really, really bad and can't ever become law. But I want to delve deep into all of the different ways that it is horrible. But not just how it's horrible, how it is perfectly emblematic of the financial priorities of basically every administration for the past couple of decades, just morphed into an even more absurd form. So as you take a look at these priorities, I want you to understand that this is basically like you had a right-wing politician who was daydreaming about all of his financial, like, wildest fantasies, and midway through that, he went insane. That's what we have here. But for Trump, it's also significant, not just in all of the cuts that he wants to propose and not in the particular places where he actually wants to put more money, which is even more revealing, but specifically a way that he is going back on a promise of the sort that has previously taken down Republican presidents. So I believe that he has reached his read my lips, no new taxes moment. Because during the campaign, during the primary, he specifically and repeatedly and clearly and verifiably said that there would be no cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And not only that, he used that as a club to bludgeon the other Republicans in the primary, saying things like, I'm not going to cut Medicare and Medicaid. Every other Republican's going to cut. And even if they wouldn't, they don't know what to do because they don't know where the money is. I do. That was Trump back in 2015. And if you check my Twitter, I'm going to be tweeting out in just a little bit all of the tweets where he said that he wasn't going to cut these programs. Mike Huckabee was going to cut these programs. Jeb Bush was going to cut these programs, but certainly not Donald Trump. After all, he's a populist. He knows that lots of his voters, lots of conservatives around the country use these programs. And that is why we were all shocked to see that his budget is proposing $1.5 trillion in cuts to Medicaid over 10 years, implementing work requirements as well as eliminating the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. So, look, the first number is the easiest to quantify in how he is attempting to decimate this program. The other parts are horrendous as well. Many Republicans will see those things like eliminating the expansion and implementing work requirements. They have been fed a steady diet from Fox News of that's going to affect the people unlike you, the non-white people. But it's going to affect tons of them too, and they will rapidly discover that if this were to become law. But $1.5 trillion, that's a lot of no cuts there. That seems like a pretty deep one, actually, especially when you combine it with an $845 billion cut to Medicare over 10 years. That's about 10% of the entire program being cut. Did George W. Bush do that? Did George H.W. Bush? Reagan, man. Oh, God. He was really cutting those domestic programs deep. Did he do that? No. No, the guy who promised very specifically not to cut these programs wants to cut off 1/10 of it and, of the other changes as well. You also have $25 billion in cuts to Social Security over 10 years, including cuts to disability insurance. Screw people who are disabled. And by the way, we're going to get to more of the stats, but understand, it's one thing to propose a budget like this when you control the House and it can be passed. And yes, it might be unpopular, but at least it happens. You get what you want. You might have a bit of bad PR, but you get what you want. It's a whole nother thing to propose incredibly unpopular cuts when you know it's never going to actually become law. It seems like this is a budget based purely on spite at that point. He's not going to get his $25 billion in cuts to Social Security, but he wants the American people to know that he wants to cut Social Security. That's an interesting political strategy. Hopefully the Democrats actually punch him in the face with this. Of course, recent history implies that they probably will not. But yeah, he wants to cut Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. So, a perfect storm, the trifecta, the EGOT of political backtracking. That is what his budget is all about. But it, of course, goes beyond that. It also wants to cut $62 billion for the Department of Education, or $7.1 billion less than the agency's allowance in 2019. So a significant cut there, not quite 10%, but it's a pretty good size cut there. And let's see, $220 billion cut to SNAP, commonly referred to as food stamps over the course of the next decade, including, again, mandatory work requirements. Not because they're needed. The vast, vast majority of the people on these programs already have work requirements. But if you continually assert that we need them, it does a great job of stigmatizing people who are on this program because those people were feeling way too much dignity. They were feeling high and mighty as they use these food stamps. We need the federal budget to slap them across the face. We've got $21 billion in cuts to temporary assistance for needy families, an already severely underfunded cash assistance program for the nation's poorest. Screw them. $207 billion in cuts to the student loan program, eliminating the public service loan forgiveness program and cutting subsidized student loans. Because apparently Donald Trump did hear somewhere in the news that there was an issue with student loans and debt. I don't think he listened long enough to know what direction we need to move in, so he's going in the opposite one. But if you have those loans, if you're expecting to go to college, if you want your kids to go to college and you don't want them to be in debt for the rest of your life, get a load of this budget that Donald Trump would love to make into law. By the way, if we go a little bit broader, 9% cuts to non-defense programs, which would hit Section 8 housing vouchers, public housing programs, Head Start, women, infants, and children nutrition program, and low-income home energy assistance programs, among others. I doubt he even knows what those programs are or that they would be cut at all, but he knows that they're not defense spending, and so they need to be drastically cut so that we can bomb more people in Yemen and Syria. Because that is, of course, where this money is going to go. Massive cuts to the programs that actual working Americans use so that we can create some explosives and drop them over the Middle East. He wants to increase defense spending by $34 billion. That is to a $750 billion budget baseline. That is a 5% boost to defense and military spending. By the way, they also have some tricky accounting there where they're actually increasing the military budget more, but they're effectively hiding it in an overseas contingency fund so that you don't know that it is going to be spent on defense. It looks like there's two different pots of money, even though they're both being loaded in the barrels of the same guns, effectively. So cuts to SNAP and for students, Medicare, Medicaid, your health insurance gone. If you want to eventually have Social Security, they want to cut that too. But they are going to give a 5% plus boost to the most expensive, best funded military in the history of humanity. So we've got that working for us, which is good. And of course, there's also the petty spending. So we can't have food stamps. We can't have TANF. We can't have $8.6 billion in funding for the southern border wall, though. We can do that. We can definitely like take that money out of the mouths of the poorest children in America, turn it into metal and drive it into the ground at the U.S.-Mexican border. We can do that. He can do that. And so here's the thing. This is the worst budget I've ever seen in my life. The numbers are worse. They are, again, they are the drug-addled mind of a man with, you know, early onset Alzheimer's. But fundamentally, what this budget seeks to achieve is not that dissimilar from budgets that we've seen throughout our life. There's always going to be cuts to these domestic programs. There's always going to be raiding Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security to pay for other priorities. That is not a new thing. And the defense budget is always going to go up. That has generally been true, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. It's controversial to cut the military. Safer to just raise it by 2, 3, 4, maybe 5% every single year. Doesn't matter if we actually need it. Doesn't matter if we can effectively fight wars on four fronts at this point. It always needs to be going up. The border wall is sort of a petty additional thing, but they were going to spend the money at the border in one way or another. So that's your budget. Absolutely horrendous, but very clearly communicating the values of the modern Republican Party and at the same time giving a gigantic middle finger to Trump's base who were promised time after time after time in easily verifiable fashion that he would not be cutting these programs that they rely on so much. Now, with that, I do want to briefly mention one additional thing. The Sunrise Movement is the youth-led climate change movement that has been driving conversation around a Green New Deal ever since they and AOC and a few other politicians protested outside of Nancy Pelosi's office just a few months ago. Since then, we've had the great fortune of having a couple of their founders and representatives on the show a number of times to talk climate change and the Green New Deal. Well, now you have a chance to see them in person because they are launching their Green New Deal tour. If you want to take a look at this poster, they've got tickets on sale now for, they're going to be town halls, hundreds of them, literally, but some in major cities that you can see down at the bottom, including Boston, Detroit, Des Moines, LA, where I'm hoping to attend, Paradise, which was, of course, one of the sort of figureheads of the horrendous wildfires of last year, San Antonio, New Orleans, Richmond, and Washington, D.C. as well. So you can head to sunrisemovement.org/tour to sign up for tickets to these events right now. I'm very hopeful that when they come to LA, we'll be able to have their representatives in studio to talk about what they hope to achieve with the tour, how they're going to continue to push the Green New Deal throughout this Democratic primary and make sure that the next Democratic president takes the threat of climate change seriously. So if you want to get involved with that, of course, you can get involved with the group itself, but you can certainly attend one of their town halls as well. And with that, we are going to take a short break. We come back. Emma Vigeland's going to be joining us. Lots to get to after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic. Or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Okay, everybody, we are very lucky once again to have on Skype Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland. Emma, welcome back to the Damage Report. Why don't we start with Nancy Pelosi has made very clear what her approach for impeachment is going to be over the next couple of years. She said, "I'm not for impeachment. Impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country and he's just not worth it." Is he worth it? Is it worth it to engage in that? What do you think about her approach to impeachment?
I mean, I think that this is typical of the Democrats and typical of her leadership style. It's a little bit frustrating because obviously if he's committed crimes, he should be impeached. The Republicans would not give us the same courtesy if we had President, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand, who had committed a felony or something like that. So I just don't understand that kind of mentality where you're going to throw down your arms and not even fight and say, we're going to unilaterally disarm before you even know if there's a reason to disarm.
Yeah, it seems like unless they're backed into a corner where the only option is to fight, if there's an excuse where they can say, we're just going to let bygones be bygones, it seems too easy for them to do that. And so, look, her fear appears to be that if we were to approach impeaching Donald Trump, that might rally some of his supporters to his side. It might make it harder for us in the 2020 election. I mean, what do you think the approach should be in evaluating whether we should pursue this or not? How much of it should be sort of a political, pragmatic thing, and how much should it be a, you know, fulfilling the what is laid out in the Constitution sort of approach?
It's got to be if he's committed a crime. I don't understand why this is complicated in any way. I mean, it's been revealed that he has committed crimes. He's individual one. Michael Cohen has made it clear. You can talk about the severity of the crime. You can make value judgments based on that. But if I were a sitting member of Congress, I would say if a president has committed a crime and it's been made clear through a federal investigation that you should proceed with impeachment going forward. And these crimes are not, you know, he didn't smoke pot and it was proven in a court of law that he did so in 1972. No, this the Michael Cohen investigation is related directly to his election. So I believe that as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said, and as other members of Congress have said, they should move forward with impeachment proceedings just based on the fact that he's committed election crimes.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that if you're a potential president and you're looking at this, you must be like, if you have any hope of ever committing crimes in office, you've got to be pumping your fist in the air. The idea that the only way that my personal corruption will ever be investigated is if it's so obviously abhorrent and the reaction is bipartisan. That's the only way that I'll be held accountable. Man, potential despots have got to be celebrating.
Right, and it sends a message, just sorry, one more point, that our justice system is as rigged and tiered as a lot of people think, that the people at the very top don't have any consequences when they commit crimes, but God forbid you have a dime bag of weed on the corner and you're black, and then you'll be going to prison.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to a Democratic primary contender, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. News broke that she had an aide that resigned over the way her staff was dealing with an accusation of sexual harassment and mistreatment by a more senior aide. Apparently, they didn't really do anything about it, so she resigned. And apparently, the man was only eventually fired last month when a media outlet contacted the campaign. What was your reaction to that news?
So this is on the scale of bad to not so bad. It's kind of, I would say, in the middle. Obviously, Kirsten Gillibrand is not directly implicated in the sexual harassment, but the fact that she didn't fire the staffer should raise some red flags, especially because I believe her candidacy is, she's running on a Me Too platform, right? So she's one of the senators and public figures in the Democratic Party who has been strongest mm-hmm. against allowing Al Franken to have any sort of public resurgence. She voted against every Trump nominee. She's been kind of the Me Too candidate. That's really, I think, what her angle is. So this obviously puts a dent in that. And I find it funny that this is not really much of what the media is focusing on when they were obsessed with the Bernie Sanders story that didn't directly implicate him either. I think that there's, it's a slippery slope when you start blaming the bosses of people who committed sexual harassment, and you start to do that kind of digging, because Kamala Harris had a similar thing happen with her in her office, and I don't want to blame people by association, but it's more damning than both the Harris and Bernie Sanders accusations, because this staffer was not adequately dealt with. And Hillary Clinton had a similar thing, by the way, in 2016, where there was a very credible and proven accusation of sexual harassment, and they just shuffled the staff around.
I know, that's what's so bizarre, especially for Kirsten Gillibrand, because I agree that she's been very strong on this particular issue. And from what the now resigned former staffer says is that there she had said that this guy was both traditionally harassing and sexually harassing her. The office says that they looked into it, and they found that he had been mistreating her, but there was no sexual harassment, which, I mean, it just sounds like her word was not enough in this particular case. And it is bizarre the amount of media attention that's paid to one case versus another. I will agree with you that I don't think that, unless it's shown that she personally protected him, which I've seen no evidence of that, the idea that she is personally responsible for it, I think, makes as little sense as it did with Bernie Sanders. But in the case of Bernie Sanders, they did fire the guy. They fired the guy long before the media got wind of it and was investigating it. They totally changed their practices to make sure that it didn't happen. In this case, and the case with Hillary Clinton, the guy kept working there until people made a big stink out of it. And so it is interesting the ways in which the media will focus and make a big deal out of certain cases and not others, even when they're not exactly the same situation.
Well, it's about weaponizing certain narratives, right? So we're seeing the same thing about reparations with Bernie Sanders. None of the other candidates are getting criticized for not supporting reparations, and literally zero of the presidential candidates will actually institute reparations if they become president of the United States. And the media sees sexual harassment and gender issues as a weakness for Bernie Sanders. So this is something we focus on for him. And for others, you know, Hillary and Kirsten Gillibrand are women, so it shouldn't be that much of an issue. But that's obviously not how it should work. And I find it frustrating that it's super selective and it's made to paint a picture of a certain candidate and not do so for another one. In ways that maybe are unconscious biases by the media, but they're still just as pervasive.
Yeah. Let's turn to another breaking news story. It was reported today that nearly 50 people have been caught up, including actresses from Full House and Desperate Housewives. It's Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman, as well as business leaders and coaches, with either paying or accepting bribes to get their kids into some of the most high-profile universities in the country. I saw, I think, Yale, Harvard, USC. I didn't see my school, UConn, on the list, but I'm assuming it's there somewhere. So scale of 1 to 10, how shocked are you to find out that big money was changing hands to make sure that the elite's kids were getting into these schools?
Look, I'm shocked at the brazenness of it. It's pretty unbelievable. Felicity Huffman was just implicated in this basically bribery ring. I shouldn't be shocked, but I guess I am. Maybe I'm just naive. I obviously know that meritocracy is a massive myth and that if you have a lot of money and you're a legacy, your chances of getting into these schools are infinitely better. I mean, coming from the Northeast, I know, just put a lacrosse stick in a rich kid's hand and they'll be on their way to Harvard. But although I wasn't that good at it, so I couldn't get in. I think that it's super indicative of where we are at as a society, where these elite colleges and universities have to have some sort of reckoning, where they are not institutions of higher learning for the people that deserve it the most. There's a massive amount of politics that goes into it, and it just underscores the need for College for All, which, let's just repeat this, is not that expensive of a proposal, much less expensive than Medicare for All, because it evens the playing field and it gets rid of the need for a lot of these people who don't have the means to bribe the admissions officials of Yale, basically, yeah. To get an education. I think that's, you know, something that we should prioritize.
Yeah, and like I was reading an article from back in, I think, 2016, talking about how Jared Kushner's father had donated like hundreds of millions or more, and he was going to get accepted into a great school. If he was going to get in there legitimately without it, you'd probably save your money, I would imagine. And look, some of these kids maybe could have gotten in. Some of them might have done well once they got in, but some of them didn't, and they took the spot of someone else who might not have had the connections and the money. One of the things I've seen talked about on social media after the story came out was some of these people who did the bribing, perfectly good liberals in general, but it showcases the philosophy where they hypothetically want to change the world so long as their world doesn't have to change. They want everyone to be lifted up, but just not if it squeezes out their kid. There's like limits to their charity in philosophy, if not in, you know, financial matters.
Well, that's kind of the philosophy around charter schools, right? Where it's like, let's sap money from everyone else for this special kid to get this grant, to go to this charter school. So their taxpayer dollars don't go to lifting up all of the boats in that specific area. That's a flawed philosophy in my view, and it's just kind of part and parcel of the issue that we're seeing here. You know, in theory, I think that everyone should be equal, but I don't want my tax dollars to be raised to help that happen. In theory, I want everyone to have a great access to education, but I don't want to make any change personally for that to actually go forward. And also, what's fascinating to me is that this all goes on behind the scenes, and then we pretend like affirmative action is an actual issue in this country. The fact that rich people are basically paying, literally outside of the admissions process, paying to get their kids into these schools. And then we're pretending like, oh, you know, these black students are really taking slots from much smarter white kids. That's absolutely not the case. this lack of meritocracy is a much bigger issue. And the fact that these universities, in at least theory, want more representation for minorities and people of color is the right way to go. This is the wrong way to go.
I agree. Emma Vigeland of Rebel HQ. Emma, thank you as always for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, John.
We're going to take a short break. Lots more after this. So for yesterday, we already knew that Tucker Carlson was in some trouble because Media Matters went through a number of his different appearances on the Bubba the Love Sponge show and found a bunch of misogynistic comments that he had made, oddly defending people with child brides and things like that. Of course, noteworthy that in the past, when he's talked about people in other cultures who take child brides is a gigantic problem. In this particular case, he found it something to be defended. But we actually have worse stuff today because more has been released, and this time it gets into areas of just out-and-out white supremacy, condescension towards other cultures, and issues like that. Here is some of what they released.
Iraq is a crappy place filled with a bunch of, you know, semi-literate primitive monkeys. But I just have zero sympathy for them or their culture, a culture where people just don't use toilet paper or forks.
Hey, and the way they treat women, you know, I agree with you. Their culture is, but you're in their homeland, and you're over there as an American who they hate, and they want nothing more than the Americans off of their soil. So they're not going to play games.
They can just shut the fuck up and obey, is my view.
How could you salvage Iraq at this point?
It's beyond our control. I mean, if somehow the Iraqis decided to behave like human beings or something.
He'd need to say, look, I'm a bigot, okay? I'm a bigot. I don't like Islamic extremists. Like, if you are really heavily into Islam, I don't care for you that much. And I don't care what that sounds like. You can call me a racist. You can come whatever the fuck you want.
And at this juncture, you could say that and not catch a lot of shit for
it. You certainly could. I'd vote for you if you said that.
You know, white men have, you know, they've contributed some, I would say. Like creating civilization and stuff. I think they've done a pretty good, I don't know, whatever.
Obama would kick your ass playing basketball.
Yeah, of course he would. Basketball, come on.
He's black, say it. He's a real brother. Hey, I don't know how black he is.
How is he black, for one thing? He has one white parent, one black parent. Why isn't he white? There's some really good, immigrants. I just think it's, you know, people who come to this country ought to have something to offer. Be hot, be really smart, you know what I mean?
Okay, so before we start breaking down how horrendous a bunch of those were, we do have to acknowledge that this was from 2006. He was a young man. He was barely 39 when he said those things. So bear that in mind, fresh out of high school, so maybe we should cut him some slack. Except maybe not. Because what you saw there was Tucker Carlson in a context where he felt like he could be himself. This wasn't Tucker Carlson reading off a teleprompter, very careful messaging so that he appeals to white nationalists, but plausible deniability so he doesn't lose all of his sponsors. This was him relaxed and just talking with the boys and revealing what he's really like. And what you saw there was like third or fourth tier racism. Like there's personal bigotry, there's personal discrimination, there's, you know, a preference for your own race. All of those absolutely horrendous, and we see those not only day-to-day in America, but, you know, driving a lot of government policy. But the belief of the fundamental superiority of your race, of your civilization, and believing that it is irrelevant what happens to other civilizations because they are semi-literate primitive monkeys, that is beyond, and that's the worst ultimate form of racism. It's the sort of racism that leads to genocide. It's the sort of racism that says, if your culture is wiped off the face of the map, it is irrelevant to me. Why are you bothering me with this nonsense? So this isn't like he made a racist comment. This is an almost apocalyptic form of racism that Tucker Carlson was just casually getting across. While also, I'm going to end up going over on this segment. I apologize. Tucker Carlson wants you to believe that he's the reasonable one. He's the intellectual. He's read a lot of books. But how intellectual is he? He says that the people in Iraq can't be governed. They can't govern themselves. They're primitive. They don't have a civilization. Okay, so let's ignore the recent context of the fact that we went in and blew their country to hell. Okay, let's ignore that. What is Iraq? What is the country of Iraq? Who are the Iraqis? Is this a civilization going back thousands of years, and after thousands of years, they still can't get their stuff together? No. Iraq was invented by the British less than a century ago, taking long-standing rival factions and saying, no, all of you, You've been fighting. You've been dueling over this area. You're all together now. Have fun with that. That is what it was. But Tucker Carlson either doesn't know or doesn't care about context. Again, he's the intellectual. But what is his intellectualism worth when it comes to evaluating a culture of a people that look dissimilar from him? It counts for nothing. His great education, he went to a great, much better school than me, doesn't mean anything when it comes to evaluating people who don't look exactly like him, who aren't heirs to frozen food fortunes like he is. He also said this, by the way. Co-host says, so basically we need a racist president. Quote, we need to get these Mexicans out of here and the Islam. Let's kill all the Muslims. Carlson says, well, I don't think. Co-host says, we need that. Carlson says, I think that you're onto something. I mean, not someone who's like a Klansman or anything. So look there. There's nuance, finally. Not someone who's a Klansman, but yes, someone who wants to kill all the Muslims. He goes on to say, I would vote for that person. A person who says 1.6 plus billion people across the globe, I want them all dead. That is what Tucker Carlson said. This isn't just like, he said something that was kind of insensitive. No, this is, again, apocalyptic genocidal racism coming out of Tucker Carlson when he is in a context where he feels like, hey, I'm surrounded by other conservative white males. I can say whatever I want and it doesn't matter. By the way, just a small thing. This just bothered me. So they were talking about FCC efforts to diversify radio programming to make sure that it's racially representative. He said, so how is that different from Jim Crow? In fact, how is that not worse than Jim Crow? I'm not going to go through answering that. We don't have the time, but I will say that if he was the intellectual he portrays himself to be, he would understand a few of the ways that it is not worse than Jim Crow. I will only say this. Tucker Carlson is being asked to apologize for what he said, and of course he's saying that he's not going to apologize. He says that he's under attack. But as I pointed out on Twitter, if you believe that us quoting you is attacking you, dude, you are hitting yourself. This is just what you said coming back. And he's not going to apologize. Why would he apologize? It's not just that his fans like this stuff. It's that he needs to say this stuff. I am not exaggerating when I say that literally the only way that you can make a name for yourself on the right wing as a commentator, a pundit, even a politician now is you have to say the worst, most sexist, misogynistic, racist stuff. That is the only way you're going to stand out from the others. Because if you don't do it, someone else will. If you won't go there, Ben Shapiro will. If you won't go there, whoever it is that runs Talking Points is going to do that. Turning Point, whatever it's called. I really don't pay that much attention to it. But that is how they make a name for themselves. Candace Owens defending Hitler wasn't some mistake. It was the next phase of her career. Has she been taken down as a result of defending Hitler? No. She is making every bit as much money, if not more, as she was the day before she said that. And Tucker Carlson is going to financially benefit from having said these insanely racist things. That is how you make a career in right-wing media. And Tucker Carlson understands that perhaps better than anyone else in the country. Now with that, we are going to take a break. We're going to talk about some awful, other awful right-wingers on the other side. We turn now to Sebastian Gorka. He not only has an absolutely ridiculous name, but a ridiculous approach to the world, especially when it comes to Islam. He is one of the most out-and-out Islamophobic people that I know of, especially one who was a close advisor to Donald Trump and now is being beamed into houses all over the country thanks to Sinclair. And joining us now to break down Sebastian Gorka, his philosophy, and his impact is Deputy Editorial Director for Media Matters for America, Pam Vogel. Pam, welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. I very much appreciated your write-up about Sebastian Gorka, which is available for people to read at the Media Matters website. So tell us about Sebastian Gorka for people who might not know who that is. Who is he and what is he out there doing?
Well, I think you kind of summed it up pretty well in your introduction. He's one of the most virulently anti-Islam voices in right-wing media, and he's also a complete grifter. So he, as you mentioned, was very briefly part of the Trump administration, and he essentially left after a few months and parlayed that into a series of media contracts. So until recently, he was a Fox News contributor, where his title was technically national security strategist, but he was often brought on to just talk about whatever the news of the day was, regardless of whether it had anything to do nominally with national security. And now he is no longer with Fox News, but he is working with a new, he has a new radio show on Salem that is nationally broadcast, and He's now officially a contributor at Sinclair Broadcast Group. So he is showing up in national news packages that they are running on their stations across the country. He has hosted some special programs that have run on Sinclair-controlled stations. And he has really just started to make that official, which I think is indicative of the potential grift factor here, because it's pretty uncommon for Fox News contributors to have contracts with other media outlets. But he was on Sinclair long before any of this was made official, while he was still under contract at Fox.
So we know that Sinclair has like their terrorism watch desk where they try to scare the hell out of people across the country. Now that he's on Sinclair, that his stuff is going out and that that gets to a lot of different Americans, if someone is tuning in and they're like Sebastian Gorka is being beamed into their face, what are the sorts of things that he's talking about? What are these segments about?
Right. And I think that's a really important note, because this is definitely part of a pattern of Sinclair's willingness to more than flirt with just completely overt xenophobia and especially anti-Islam rhetoric, not just those terrorism alert desk segments, which I watched a whole year of them, all of 2017.
Oh, my God.
And it was really remarkable how much it essentially relies on the tropes of propaganda. It's repetition, and it's making especially older viewers or viewers who don't have access to as many other news outlets absolutely terrified out of their minds of imminent terror attacks happening in their neighborhoods in, you know, Ohio or wherever. So now that Gorka is showing up on Sinclair, he is doing a combo of what he was doing at Fox, which is just giving random sound bites in their news packages, whether or not they're about national security stories. Some have been about, for example, there was a recent segment he was in just yesterday, actually, this is brand new, where they asked him for comments about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's critique of the New Deal and how it promoted racist redlining policies. It had absolutely nothing to do with anything he even purports to be an expert at. And then these special programs, he's hosted at least two that have run on Sinclair stations. Those are a little bit more shady because they're produced by an outside organization, but they're only airing on Sinclair stations. And one that aired about a year ago was called The Clash of Cultures, and it was all about, quote unquote, rise of terrorism. And he talked about, whether or not Islam and Western ideals could ever be, let's see if I have the right word here. I want to make sure I get it right because the quote is extremely upsetting. We talk about if they could ever be reconciled and the difference between Western ideals and so-called Islamic ideals. He talks about Sharia law all of the time. Mm-hmm. And this particular must-run segment, or not must-run segment, but a whole special program that ran on tons of stations, showed a bunch of B-roll of people holding signs that said things like rapefugees instead of refugees. So we're seeing a taste of what he's capable of injecting into local news.
Wow. Okay. Well, that is a great preview, a trailer for what he's going to be bringing to Sinclair. So I want to thank you for doing this analysis, joining us on the show. I do want to apologize that you had to watch so many of these segments. You're probably like 2 to 5% less mentally stable as a result of that. But we do appreciate you and the rest of Media Matters doing this very important work. We always appreciate the work that you guys do.
Of course, we watch it, so you hopefully don't have to.
Thank you. And I will try not to. Pam Vogel, thank you for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back, just a little bit of time left to close out the show. AOC at South by Southwest. Let's see how she characterizes moderates. I think you're going to enjoy it. For a long time in America, the moderate has been worshipped. It has this sort of mythic quality, a person who sort of stands aside from the radicals to the left and the radicals to the right and charts a more pragmatic path, understanding what's really going on. Well, at South by Southwest, AOC sort of took the wind out of the sails of that myth, and she portrayed moderates in an amazing, easy-to-understand way. Here's what she said.
Moderate is not a stance, it's just an attitude toward life of like, meh. We've become so cynical that we view meh or we view cynicism as an intellectually superior attitude. And we view ambition as youthful naivete. When we think about the greatest things we have ever accomplished as a society have been ambitious acts of vision.
Okay, I want to repeat that last part. So when we think about the greatest things we've ever accomplished as a society have been ambitious acts of vision, and the meh is just worship now for what? And I love that. There's, like, that's what I've been feeling, and maybe you can agree, but haven't been able to put as concisely. So we saw this on display over the weekend with Delaney, who's running for president right now, and he's pitching himself as a pragmatic progressive, charting the middle road. He wants bold action in terms of words, not in terms of action, and it is very much a stance of we really can't achieve anything. Maybe I am aware enough and have studied enough to know that we face big challenges. I get that. I'm not one of the people who doesn't get it. But I will do absolutely nothing to actually meet those challenges. It's like, climate change, maybe we can subsidize wind a little bit or something like that. It is this sort of lackadaisical, cynical view of what humanity is actually capable of accomplishing. And that's not how I was raised. I don't think that's how a lot of Americans were raised. I was raised on, they're going to make fun of me in the control room. I was raised on Star Trek. I was raised on the idea that we can become better people individually and collectively, that we can achieve great things. And we can look back over the history of the last century, the history of America, the history of humanity at large, and we can see great things that were done, but they were never done as a result of a bunch of powerful, influential, rich people saying, that is not how you accomplish great things. But it's one thing when politicians do that and when they're able to get into power, with this being their sort of guiding philosophy. That's bad enough, but we cannot as people succumb to this same sort of thing. I personally believe that there's two versions of this. There's meh and there's meh. Where one is sort of like a hands-off, what could really be accomplished meh, and the other is a more personally cynical, superior sort of meh. I know what's really going on, and you idiots think that something can actually change. You think that some politicians can actually do good things. That is cynical, too, in exactly the way that AOC is describing. And both forms of that cynicism, the lazy and the aggressive, if they drive American political participation, we will not actually meet these goals. They are self-fulfilling prophecies in a very real way. And only by being driven by the same sort of ambitious acts of vision that she's talking about there in running for office personally, like she and many others did this last time around, by supporting candidates that actually understand and will do something about the challenges, will we produce the America that we want to live in? Like, there are some people who honestly just want to feel superior, and a little bit of knowledge can produce that. And there are people out there that know that you want this feeling. There are people who write, they write books, they have shows that want to make you feel superior and understand that for some that is enough. It does not actually have to be paired with action. It doesn't have to be paired with results. Thankfully, we have people like AOC that are talking the talk and walking the walk at the same time, and we should take that as an example for ourselves. Now, I do want to thank a couple of people before we close out the show who have done reviews on iTunes. So McKurt27 said, I have a beard. John has a beard. Well, he used to anyway. Man, he looks weird without his beard. I'm keeping mine. Helps that I don't have to watch him anymore now that I found the Damage Report as a podcast. I thought I'd be missing something without the visuals, but really, John does an excellent job speaking descriptively, so I don't feel like I'm missing much. Super informative and excellent production value. A+. Well, all the stuff in terms of the production value, making it look good and professional, don't give me absolutely any of the credit of that. I don't know how to do that. And if I did, I probably wouldn't prioritize it, but thankfully there are people who do. Let's move on from the beard, though, people. I've got facial hair again. You can see it. It's sparse, but it's good. It's good. 561Ace said, dude, I've been waiting for you to get your own show for a while. I really appreciate you giving the news with minimal opinion attached to it. You already realize how intelligent your audience is, so you don't have to over-explain. Thank you so much for that commentary as well. So for those of you who haven't yet, we do have a podcast. It's available on iTunes and Pocket and Stitcher and everything, basically. You can get it there. You can watch our videos on youtube.com/thedamagereport. You can go to twitter.com/thedamagereport and follow us there as well. But if you do listen to the podcast, please do the 5 stars thing. Leave a written review. It will be read at some point on the show because we appreciate you doing that and helping us to spread the message and make sure that new people are exposed to the show as well. Thank you for following us today. We'll be back tomorrow with much more for you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.